Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. President Obama tried to lay some groundwork for this Thursday's bipartisan televised meeting on healthcare by outlining which aspects of the congressional healthcare reform plans he supports and offering some provisions of his own. Joining me to discuss the president's $950 billion plan and what's next for the healthcare effort, Marilyn Serafini, healthcare and welfare correspondent from the National Journal. Laura Meckler is here. She's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Thank you all so much for joining me, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We'll be opening the phones in just a while. The number here is 1-800-433-8850. You can also send your questions and your comments by email, of course, to drshow@wamu.org or via Facebook and Twitter. Laura, there's been a big debate ever since Scott Brown won that seat, surprisingly, in Massachusetts for the Republicans a few weeks ago about whether the president would basically scale back on healthcare reform or give it one final push. He seems to have gone for the final push.
That's exactly right. What we saw yesterday was him sort of going all in on healthcare. He is going to give it one more try. And in advance of Thursday's summit, where the White House and will meet with congressional Republicans and Democrats to talk about the issue, he's put his cards on the table, a path forward for Democrats in Congress should they choose to take it. It's not yet clear whether they have the support to make this happen. But what the president has done is laid out a policy framework that they could use and a procedural framework that they could use to move this bill through if they want to.
So the White House posted this up on their website yesterday morning, Marilyn, caused a great fuss around Washington. What was in it and what wasn't in it?
Absolutely. Well, the president's plan mostly looks like the bill that the Senate has already passed. In fact, that's what they say. If you don't see anything new on a provision, they took the Senate provision. So basically what it means is there still would be an individual mandate. It would still require most people to purchase insurance. There still would be subsidies. In fact, the subsidies in this plan, in the president's plan, are even greater than were in the Senate-passed or the House-passed bill. There is one new provision of note, and this is very interesting. It has to do with insurance. And you know, we've seen in the news lately that Anthem Blue Cross of California was going to raise its rates, their premium rates, 39%. That caused a huge criticism and attacks all over Washington. The Secretary of Health, Kathleen Sebelius, put out a whole report on these big rate increases while these companies are making profits. The House Energy and Commerce Committee is holding a hearing on this issue this week. Now, President Obama responded to that by including a provision in his bill that would give the federal government some new authority to oversee insurance company rate increases. This is really a big deal, because currently the states have the authority to regulate insurance, and many of the states already monitor rate increases. So this would be a movement of power from the states to the federal government.
Okay, Karen Tumulty, the insurance side of this seems to be a very big part of what is different from the White House plan, but there are a couple of other things as well that have been taken out of the Senate bill that are in the Obama proposal.
That's right, because while this bill was sort of framed as a prelude to this summit, which is on Thursday, which is supposed to be reaching out to Republicans. In fact, if you look at the bill, what it did was move a little bit to the left. This is a bill that was designed primarily to bring aboard members of the House Democrats. And so one of the biggest things that happened with this bill was they drastically scaled back the so-called Cadillac tax, the tax that the Senate had put in there on high-cost insurance plans. This is important because this is one of the things that most economists would tell you can really bring healthcare costs under control. So now the White House is saying, you know, this is not going to happen so much in the first decade of this bill, but out in the second decade, it's still going to have teeth. The second thing they did was they put in a new tax on on it's a Medicare payroll tax on unearned income. In other words, investment income. It's a pretty stiff tax. It's almost 3%. This is to essentially raise the money that they were losing from doing some of these other things, like making the subsidies for people to buy insurance more generous and by scaling back this Cadillac tax.
Laura, they also took out the special deal for Nebraska.
Right. Well, that was highly criticized. One of the things that really hurt this effort was Ben Nelson negotiated extra federal money to pay for the Medicaid expansion, but for Nebraska only. He later said, oh, I was just doing that to get it for everybody. Well, if that was his goal, he succeeded, because they actually have increased federal support for all states' Medicaid programs in order to pay for the expansions that are in this bill. But they did take out the so-called Cornhusker kickback, and they're hoping that that will go away.
Let's talk a little bit more about something Karen raised there, which was the cost, because one of the criticisms of the Senate bill had been that it expanded coverage to an extra 30 million Americans, but that it didn't do very much to reduce the increases in healthcare costs in the country. And that is something that had worried healthcare economists. It doesn't seem that the White House provision changes that very much, does it?
Well, there are a couple different ways they went about trying to control costs. Part of the problem is that it's a very hard thing to do, and there's no surefire easy ways to go about doing it. There are a bunch of pilot programs in the Senate where they're just basically essentially trying a whole bunch of different experiments through Medicare to see if they can control healthcare spending. One of the things that health economists were most optimistic about in terms of controlling spending was this Cadillac tax that Karen mentioned, an effort to discourage high-priced plans where you essentially have almost no co-pays or cost-sharing for consumers. The idea is if you have to pay something, you might think twice before a doctor suggests another test or another x-ray when you've already had one, for instance. So we've scaled that back. What the White House said is that or more to the point, the White House has scaled that back. What the White House said was that they're still optimistic that it will help long term because it'll kick in 2018, and then in the second decade it'll start to have effects. But that's a long ways away, and you know, a lot can happen between now and then.
I don't like quoting other journalists when I've got such good journalists here, and you've all written about this, but David Brooks in the New York Times calls this a fiscal time bomb. He says the revenue will never come, Marilyn.
Well,
because of this 2018 provision.
Right, right, exactly. And that is one of the, that has been one of the primary ways in which the CBO has scored these bills so far as lowering costs. It's also important to note that the president's bill would add $75 billion to the federal government's cost for these bills. So whereas the Senate passed bill would have cost $800 billion plus, his bill is going to cost, or his plan would cost, $900 billion plus. And that could be a real sticking point for Republicans who were already very concerned about the cost of the bills on the table.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the politics. We've talked about the content of the White House proposal. Karen and Marilyn, they're mentioning that this could be one of the sticking points of Republicans. This meeting on Thursday is going to be bipartisan. It's also going to be televised significantly, but is there really very much bipartisanship left in the healthcare reform debate?
No. And
in Washington at all, on almost anything at the moment?
You know, I think this, first of all, I wouldn't be at all surprised, and it's just a hunch, if the president didn't, because the bill that he put out yesterday really didn't have anything new in it to reach out to Republicans. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he had a thing or two up his sleeve on Thursday, maybe something to do with medical malpractice. But that is not going to bring any Republicans aboard. The White House and the congressional leaders know that there is essentially one road out here. And it's essentially got, you know, as I think I saw a quote this morning, there's one last exit on this road. And that would essentially require two things. It would require the House to pass the Senate bill, and then for the House and Senate to use this procedure we've been hearing a lot about, reconciliation, where you can get around the Senate filibuster by only passing something with a 51 votes, where you would come back then and tinker with the Senate bill. And these are the sort of fixes that were being proposed. But I don't think anybody at this point thinks that comprehensive reform, at least, is going to have much Republican, if any, Republican support.
Laura.
And the Republicans have made very clear. They've said over and over they want to scrap this bill and start again. And Democrats have absolutely no interest in doing that. I think that it is true that the White House is likely to say that they're incorporating Republican ideas. And I know that people at the White House have looked very carefully at what Republicans have proposed and are prepared to say, sure, we'll accept this, we'll accept that, but within the framework of their larger bill. So they'll be able to say, hey, we're reaching out, we're including your ideas. What's the problem? You're still not voting for this? But in fact, Republicans don't want their ideas incorporated into the Democratic bill because they don't like the underlying Democratic bill. They don't want to spend $950 billion on this problem right now.
Right. And they're also saying, Marilyn, that this meeting on Thursday is effectively a setup.
Well, you know, President Obama is going into this meeting. Again, the Republicans wanted to start from scratch. President Obama has now laid a plan on the table. And he said, my arms are still open. Come on in, bring your proposals. But he already has a plan on the table. And when it comes down to it, the same ideological, major ideological differences that there were between the Republicans and the Democrats when we first started this process still exist. The differences have not gone away.
So out of Thursday's meeting, we may get something that looks like a bill that'll be passed through a procedural vote, but it won't be a bipartisan process.
That is sounding more and more likely. You know, in the end, if we end up going to reconciliation, in the end, if everything fails, the states are already setting up model legislation. They're already proposing legislation to make some of the kinds of changes that they would like to see. So they're already looking beyond what could be failure.
Marilyn Serafini, healthcare correspondent for the National Journal. Laura Meckler from the Wall Street Journal is also here. Karen Tumulty from Time Magazine is with me. The phone number is 1-800-433-8850. Our email address is drshow@wmu.org. Do stay with us for more on our conversation on healthcare reform. We're going to take a quick break. Stay listening. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our conversation on healthcare reform. Looking forward to the White House meeting on Thursday between Democrats and Republicans on the issue, looking at the substance of the White House's new proposal that they've put out, and of course the politics of this, because it is almost as much a political process at the moment as it is a healthcare process, it seems to me. Our phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. I wanted to read, Laura, since you're from the Wall Street Journal, and I'm going to, you know, appreciate that you work on the news pages and not on the editorial pages, but a quick, the last couple of sentences of your paper's editorial this morning, talking about the Democrats and President Obama, writes, they want what they want and they're going to play by Chicago rules and try to dragoon it into law on a narrow partisan vote via congressional rules that have never been used for such a major change in national policy. If you want to know why Democratic Washington is ungovernable, this is it.
Well, arguably, some would say this is how you govern Washington in a situation where you really don't have agreement between the parties over how to move forward. This has the editorial is accurate in that this procedure, which Karen mentioned before, called reconciliation, was designed to be used for budgetary matters. It has, however, been used for a lot of things over the past. I mean, it was used to enact former President Bush's tax cuts. It was used under President Clinton for welfare reform and for creation of the state children's
health insurance.
Which
was a major change in American law.
Yes, welfare reform was a major change. I guess a bit of the difference is budget reconciliation is meant to be used for things that have a specific impact on the federal budget. Welfare reform definitely
clearly
had that. This bill as a whole has some things that affect the budget, some things that don't. But the way they're going to get around using it for this bill is that they're going to only be essentially tweaking the Senate bill through the reconciliation rules. So it is in that respect a new use of reconciliation, but I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say that it's never been used for major legislation before.
Karen, it's interesting that Laura said there straight away, well, maybe some people would say this is how you do govern, that actually using Chicago rules is the way to get things done in Washington. And you know, perhaps the president misjudged, you know, the talk about bipartisanship. It says on the campaign trail, of course, everybody says they want it. And the voters say they want to see how Washington changes. But actually what they really want is things to get passed.
Well, right now, one of the biggest political motivators that the Democrats have going right now are these midterm elections. And the sense that their leaders have and are arguing with them is that if they can't get this done, that the voters are going to look on them and say, wait, you know, we elected you guys to govern. So I think our article, I mean, the Wall Street Journal editorial is sort of backwards here. Can I make one other point about process, too? One of the things the Democrats feel they need to do is get past talking about process, and they cannot do that until they get a bill passed. If they can get this bill passed, it is going to rise and fall on whether people like it and whether it actually does what it promises it's going to do. If it succeeds, people are not going to care what got it there.
Right. So in history, we will look back, if it passes history and it works, people will look back in history and say it was passed and it worked. They won't actually look at these months of wrangling and at the process that delivered the bill.
Yeah, even if you look at the history of Medicare was the product of a whole, in 1964, was the product of a whole series of backroom deals. That was not exactly, you know, done out in the open either. And so I do think that, again, if they can get this done, which is still questionable, it's gonna rise or fall on its own merits.
Marilyn, is it your sense that, and several editorials have said this morning in the morning's papers, talking about the White House putting forward their plan now and President Obama finally coming up with his own proposal, if he had done this, if he had been more engaged 8 months ago, would we have moved faster on healthcare reform, or are the issues so difficult that it wouldn't have made much difference, in fact?
The issues, of course, are very difficult, very fundamentally difficult. However, President Obama made a very concerted effort not to make the same mistakes that President Clinton made when President Clinton, in the early 90s, sought major healthcare reform. He put a very specific plan on the table. That angered Congress. They felt like they did not have a seat at the table. It angered the stakeholders, the hospitals, the doctors, the everybody out there, the interest groups, because they did not have a seat at the table. President Obama very consciously took the opposite approach in standing back and allowing Congress to legislate. And to make sure that the interest groups had a say in what was moving forward. Now, there are many people around Washington who have been waiting. When is it that President Obama is going to step in and provide some leadership? In December, when the Senate was trying to pass its bill, he was traveling around the world for a good part of December. And there was a lot of question about whether he should have been at home really pushing, cheerleading, getting more involved than he had. So was it the right or wrong decision? Well, we now have two opposite approaches, one where President Clinton was very involved, it didn't work, and now one where President Obama held back, and so far it hasn't worked.
Laura.
I think that that's very true, everything that Marilyn just said. I think that, you know, it's sort of a, you know, too hot, too cold. You want to find just right in between. I think what a lot of the frustration was is that as Congress was wrangling with this effort, there were times when they really seemed to be stuck and could have used perhaps a White House push to move it along. The White House allowed the process to unfold in Congress at a fairly slow pace, especially in the first half or the first two-thirds of 2009. And that's when those progress really needed to be done. It needed to really get out of Senate committee much earlier than it did. Obviously in retrospect, and there were people who said this at the time, the White House needed to take a more active role. And also the White House was really kind of trying to have it both ways on a key question that was part of this debate last year, which was whether to have a public option to compete with private insurance companies. The liberal wing of the Democratic Party wanted and still wants this very, very badly, but the sort of legislative strategists have believed from the start that there were not sufficient votes in the Senate to get it into law. So the White House knew both of those things and sort of sent mixed messages. Yes, we want this, but no, it's not a deal breaker if we don't have it. And that allowed the debate to continue on and on and on over the public option. And I think it also helped the Republicans paint this bill as a big government takeover, all over the public option, or largely over the public option, which is in the end, if there is a bill, not going to be in the bill, as many people knew from the start.
Right. And it is not, we should have pointed that out right at the beginning. It's not, of course, in President Obama's bill that he posted on the White House website yesterday. Let's talk a little bit more about public opinion, Karen. What do the latest polls tell us that Americans want and don't want with respect to health, the overhaul of healthcare?
Well, you look over the last few months, and public support of this bill and public trust in the Democrats and President Obama's handling of healthcare has plummeted. And this is particularly true among independent voters. Now, there are a number of polls out where you ask people, do you want them to keep working on this? And the answer is yes. But I don't really trust those questions so much, because if you ask people, do you want Congress and the president to keep working on pretty much anything, they'll say yes.
Of course. But in terms of the actual substance of and measuring it up against President Obama's latest proposal, what's in there and what isn't in there that jibes with what the public opinion
They
wants?
Have got a big sell job to do, because they have lost a lot of support for the specifics of this bill. But I also think that is all tied up with the fact that we've spent so much of the last 6 months talking about process, and legislative process is ugly. And as people see that, and if that's all they're hearing about, they figure, I don't know what's coming out of this thing, but there's nothing in there for me.
Laura, to what extent is Thursday's meeting, do you think, going to turn out to be political theater? I mean, the fact that it's televised, some people have said that's a good thing because it puts pressure on both sides to cooperate and show that they're cooperating. Other people have said it's a bad thing because it's much harder to compromise when the cameras are turned on you. President Obama has said he actually doesn't want this to be political theater. Chances?
100%, I would say. I mean, but just because it's political theater doesn't mean it won't serve a point in the process. I mean, if anyone's tuning into this looking for Republicans and Democrats to really hammer out a bipartisan agreement, I think that they will be sorely disappointed. Now, I think
At this stage, there's little impetus for either side to compromise. Is it the Republicans feel that they're in a good position letting the Democrats go forward with something that the public doesn't particularly want, and Democrats feel that they can just paint Republicans as being obstructionists and they're going to get through this through on procedural grounds anyway?
Well, I don't know if the Democrats know they may or may not get it through on procedural grounds. They hope it will. More to the point, they just have very different ideas about how to do this. I mean, there is some real there. There are very different philosophical approaches to this program, this problem. And that's why you're not going to see any bipartisan compromise coming out on Thursday, because what the White House is really doing is laying the groundwork for this final push to move this bill through Congress. Now, that's not to say it's impossible that there would ever at any point be a bipartisan bill. there might be an effort to, if they can't do it this way, to slim it down. And there might be political pressure if it's, if they truly do something that is very popular and is viewed by the public as a really good idea, then there may be some Republicans who want to support it in the end. But the idea that it will be down the line if it happens, maybe the seeds could be planted on Thursday. But I think most of what we're going to see is both sides angling for position, trying to make their ideas, their approach look better and not get pulled into any kind of traps from the other side.
Marilyn, what do you reckon? Having the cameras there a good idea or a bad idea in terms of actually getting something done?
Well, let's remember also that the Republicans had just until the last couple of days, they weren't even sure whether they were going to show up at the summit. They didn't see a whole lot in it for them. They didn't feel like it was going to lead to much. Politically, how could they not show up? And so what we had is, just within the last couple of days, we've had the Republicans say, okay, we're going to be there. But I wholeheartedly agree with Laura that this is really just a step in the process.
I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email, of course, to drshow@wamu.org. And we are going to go to the phones to Greg in Birmingham, Alabama. Greg, thank you for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. I appreciate your taking my call.
Great. You've got a question for our panel.
Well, I guess I had a comment or I'd like to get their feedback. I continually hear about silos of legislation, jobs bills versus health care reform. And to me, having been in the health care field, benefits field consulting for 20-something years, it seems to me that they're interrelated. We spend almost $2.5 trillion a year on health care. Almost half of that is ostensibly lifestyle-related, if you listen to the CDC, and can be prevented. And there's so much waste in this area. If we can get legitimate health care reform, you can spur jobs for particularly small businesses to free up cash for them to be able to hire people and become much more efficient. And yet, we hear talk about dumping health care reform legislation in favor of a jobs bill, and nobody seems to link the two things together.
Greg, very interesting point you're making there, because several people have said in the White House and in newspapers and healthcare economists, healthcare reform is linked to jobs, but it doesn't seem to have been a message that the White House and the president has been very effective in getting out to the American public, does it, Karen?
Well, Greg really gets to a good point here, because one of the great instigators at the beginning of this exercise, even during the presidential campaign, was business. Unlike in 1994, you actually had leaders in the business community this time around coming around saying, we have to do something to reform this healthcare system. The problem was that the financial markets collapsed in between the campaign and Barack Obama's inauguration. So there came a moment in the White House early on when a number of the president's advisors said, look, healthcare is just going to be too much to ask when we're trying to do all these other things. And so that's why I think, it is suddenly, the fact is, if you ask the public what they are most concerned about, it's their jobs. And so anything that looks as though the president is taking his eye off the ball is going to be a problem.
Why do you think the White House didn't do a better job of linking healthcare to jobs?
I think because there is just so much noise right now. There are so many crises going on at once. It's a very difficult thing to do. I did an interview with the president in July, and in the interview, he was one of the greatest communicators we've ever seen, expressing great frustration. He said, I know this is an argument. I look at the data. It should be a simple argument to make with the country, and yet I'm frustrated at my own inability to connect on this one.
Let's go to Patrick in San Antonio, Texas. Patrick, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
I've lived in Europe some extensive time, and I've experienced the healthcare systems there. Everything seems to be so complicated here in the United States, and it seems that we're always trying to reinvent the wheel and come up with new systems. Why can't we simply adopt one of the European models, whether it be British, German, or French, and then simply modify it to work for our own systems here? In the meantime, I'm self-employed. I've had to give up my health insurance because of extravagant premiums, And we're talking about 2018 and 10 years down the road and so far. In the meantime, I need health insurance today, not tomorrow.
Patrick, interesting points that you raised there, both on people who are self-employed and their insurance, and on looking around the world, because I know a lot of people have done it. T.R. Reid wrote a very interesting book, the report from the Washington Post, looking at different healthcare systems around the world. Of course, not just the European ones, the Japanese have an interesting program as well, too. But effectively, Laura, the idea of some sort of public option, as we do have in Europe, is not viable here, or not viable politically.
That's correct. And in fact, it's really more of a single-payer system in most of Europe, where the government is the insurance company. You don't have private insurance companies. That's not true in every European country, but that's true in some of them. And that is what some on the left would really like to see in the U.S., but there really is not support for that.
And Marilyn?
You know, it's also important to note that many of the European countries, yes, they do have a more single-payer type system, but they are struggling as well. And they are struggling to figure out how to keep their costs down. And in doing so, they are starting to look more to the private sector and to look more to private insurers and how to incorporate a mix of the government offering, running the system, but using private insurers. So
with caps on and rules on what private insurers can and can't
correct.
Do in terms
of profitability. There is certainly significantly more regulation and more rules over in Europe, but it's a little too simplistic to say that they have this public system, we have a private system. It's more complicated than that.
Marilyn Serafina from the National Journal, Laura Meckler is here from the Wall Street Journal, Karen Tumulty from Time Magazine. Please do stay with us for more of our conversation on the state of healthcare reform in America. The phone number is 1-800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, celebrating Black History Month and investing in strong futures for kids at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Tibetan women on the edge of history. A third-generation Chinese-American recounts the stories of four women in Tibet whose lives were torn apart when China took control in the 1950s. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Katty Kay, sitting in for Diane. You've joined our conversation on the state of healthcare reform in the country, looking, of course, ahead to the meeting, bipartisan televised meeting, on Thursday. We've got an email here from Bonnie in Silver Spring, Maryland. Bonnie writes, "Yesterday, I got a letter from Blue Cross Blue Shield, which has been my insurance company for 25 years. I'm self-employed. My rate has been $834 a month for 2 years. It's now being raised to $1,031 a month. I still have to pay 20% of all my doctor's bills. This comes in a year when both my orthopedist and my gynecologist have announced that they'll no longer accept Blue Cross Blue Shield. My family physician has never accepted it. I have no dental coverage, no coverage for eye exams, and they don't even pay for a flu shot. I'd like to hear the president ask Republicans what kind of financial break their plan will give me or what they think I should do. Laura, your comments on Bonnie's email.
Well, the White House has seized on large increases by private insurance companies, as Marilyn mentioned near the top of the show, in order to make the case, renewed effort to make the case that insurance premiums are rising and that's why we need to act right now. They've spotlighted an increase in California by WellPoint Insurance, but I'm sure that if the president heard her story, Bonnie's story, he would add it to the mix.
And we're looking there at about a 20% increase.
Right. So it is very tough for people. In terms of what the Republicans would do to help her, they would say that she could buy insurance from perhaps a company doing business in a different state where there were fewer state regulations and the price would be lower. Chances are it would still be fairly expensive no matter where she's going to buy it. So it's a tough situation.
Karen, to what extent does the decision by Anthem Blue Cross of California to raise rates by, I think it's 39%, change things politically for the White House?
I think Anthem Blue Cross has made probably the most articulate argument for massive health care reform that we've heard, ironically enough, coming from an insurance company. Now, these are people like Bonnie who are in the worst situation among people who get insurance. Those of us who are lucky enough to have insurance through our employers, you know, okay, the deductibles have been going up, the premiums have been going up, but it's really people who have to go out because they're self-employed or because their employer doesn't provide them insurance, who have to go out and buy it on their own, who are in the absolute worst spot in our system, and they don't get the, you know, the benefits of pooling together large numbers of people. And I think
so they can't negotiate those prices down.
But what people keep forgetting about this bill is the basic architecture of this bill is to create gigantic, they call them exchanges, but essentially like shopping malls of insurance where people who are in this individual market can go out and buy insurance and, you know, sort of enjoy some of the benefits that those of us who are covered by our employers get.
Let's go back to the phones now to Nancy in Matawan, Michigan. Nancy, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to raise the question a little bit about real cost of health care. I used to work in a program for indigent population in Kalamazoo area. And as you may know, Michigan has a state medical program, which is for very, very low-income adults. And every once in a while, Granholm would close the rosters on this program in order to balance the budget. Well, it looks really good on paper. Suddenly, the state looks like it has enough money there, and the costs are being controlled. But it doesn't take a genius to understand that people are still going to be seeking health care, and there are still going to be costs. So people who previously perhaps had coverage to go to the doctor now are going to end up in the ER. That's just one group. Then you have people like me who don't have any insurance at all. I can't afford the premiums on my own. And I actually haven't been to the doctor in probably a year and a half, which is the longest I've been without seeing anyone. But there are plenty of people who still need to be seen or who get a tragic diagnosis and need to have care. So there are all these real costs of health care compared to this, you know, gigantic bill that everybody wants to have a fit about that, oh, how are we going to afford to pay for this? Well, we are paying for it. It's just that we don't see it on paper. And I'm wondering if your guests could talk a little bit about the real cost of health care that we just aren't seeing.
Nancy, that's a really interesting point that you raise. Karen.
Yes, and it's not just people who get these tragic diagnoses. One of the biggest drivers of health care costs are chronic illnesses that if you can treat them on a day-in, day-out basis can be contained. But if you, say, have people with diabetes who are not getting that treatment and don't show up at the ER until they need an amputation, then you're talking about a whole different ballgame in health care costs. So this is not only a humanitarian issue, it is very much an economic issue. It's keeping people in the system where their problems can be dealt with in the most efficient and effective way.
And I remember visiting a hospital down in Nashville, Tennessee, doing a story on healthcare and going to the ER, going around the emergency room, and the doctor saying, listen, we will get people coming in here with a cold effectively because they don't have health insurance, they can't go to a primary care physician, so they're ending up in the most expensive area of the whole healthcare system, and we're treating them at 10 times what it would cost a primary care physician to treat them at. And so there are these huge costs built into this system, as Nancy was saying, Laura.
Right. And the Democratic plan aims to try to fix that by doing a few different things, by creating these exchanges, these marketplaces where you can shop for coverage with the power of a group, but more to the point, also providing subsidies so people can afford the premiums, because the premiums are not going to come down overnight just because we have these exchanges. But the government would provide subsidies to help people afford them. And in addition, it would allow people to get coverage who have pre-existing conditions. Because right now, if you have a pre-existing condition, and it doesn't have to be cancer, it can be something that you think is somewhat minor, you may be denied care.
You know, there's another provision that appears in every bill, both President Obama's new proposal, the Senate bill, the House bill, and this is even a proposal that the Republicans like, and that is to help states to expand their high-risk pools. These are pools of insurance that many states operate now to help to get insurance to the sickest people, the hardest to insure people. Now, the price is often still too high for many people to afford. And as this emailer was saying, you have situations also where the states end up closing their enrollment. They have long waiting lists. Now, the House Republicans, John Boehner, the leader of the Republicans in the House, what he would like to see is to have the federal government pour some more money into these state high-risk pools to help people to the hardest to insure people to get insurance. It now in the House and the Senate bills, we're talking more about a temporary measure until some of these other provisions can be put in place, like the exchanges and the subsidies.
Okay, let's go to Henry in Margate, Florida. Henry, you've joined the program. You have a question for our panel.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You know, Republicans claim that they have better ideas on fixing our broken healthcare system. My question is, why did they not fix this thing when they were in power? And one quick thing, if Democrats don't get this done, okay, they can forget about getting my vote, because, you see, we gave them the majorities in the House and the Senate to fix the problem that George Bush and these Republicans caused. But all they have done is bicker amongst themselves. So if they don't get this done, forget about my vote. Thank you.
I've got three people with their eyes wide. But Henry points to a very real problem that the Democrats have. They have lost a lot of trust. And the note also said that Henry was very keen on a public option. He's not getting that in this bill. There are people who are very dissatisfied with the way this has been handled, Laura.
The liberal part, especially of the Democratic Party, the base, President Obama's base, is just incredibly frustrated. They, as you mentioned, have already had to give up on the public option. And if they don't get anything at all, it does sort of pose the question of, you know, what was the point? And I've heard other people ask the question, you know, if President Obama cannot get this bill through when he has a large majority in the House and even 59 votes in the Senate, which is by historic standards, a huge majority, even if it isn't the magic 60, then it raises the question of, can you ever do this? As for why President Bush and the Republicans didn't try to do this, this clearly was not one of their top priorities.
Karen.
President Bush actually did have a pretty radical health care proposal
of
his own,
right,
which would have essentially it would have done a lot to sort of take health care out of the system where by changing the tax treatment of it the way so that you wouldn't be necessarily tied to your employer as your provider of health insurance. And that didn't get anywhere in a Republican Congress.
But it is something that is extremely difficult to do and has been extremely difficult to do for decades. And perhaps we shouldn't be surprised at the amount of wrangling that it's taken to get even this far.
Well, we shouldn't be surprised by it. But I think that, President Obama himself said last year that if it doesn't get done this year, it's going to be another, you know, political generation before somebody tries again. And I think a lot of people think he's right about that.
Okay, let's go to Deborah in Keystone Heights, Florida. Deborah, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to make a comment. I listened to the Republicans for a long time talk about the right to life, that women shouldn't have abortion, et cetera, et cetera. I recently had thyroid cancer, one of the most curable cancers that there are, and my hospital bill, just the hospital bill, was $43,000 for my operation. Thank goodness I have insurance. But what would someone who did not have insurance do? They would have had to have died from one of the most curable cancers there are, because who can afford $43,000 just for an operation? Where is our right to life when we get older and have these kinds of medical problems? That's the question I want to pose to the Republicans. Thank you.
Marilyn.
Well, that's the biggest concern. We were talking a little earlier about polls and what the public is thinking these days about health reform. What drove us to health reform in the first place was that people were very concerned about their costs. It used to be that the concern was, how many more people can we get covered? And that still is a concern. But the overriding concern that drove this health care reform process was, and still is, what can I afford? And we've got this whole new group of people called the worried insured. These are people who have the insurance, and they're very concerned they're going to lose what they have because they cannot afford it, even if they're getting it through
people
their
employers. People like Bonnie, who emailed us from Silver Spring, people like Deborah Clilly.
Exactly. People who are facing these enormous rate increases in their premiums. And so the question really is, can you get enough help to these people so that they can afford insurance? And can you bring the cost of health care down so that it lowers the cost of insurance?
Karen, how does Marilyn's point about the worried insured square with the polls that show us that something like 75% of Americans are actually happy with the insurance that they have and with the healthcare system they have?
Well, I think that that's where what Marilyn is talking about is sort of where the debate started. But what happened along the way through the, you know, August town hall meetings and the accusations that the government was creating death panels, that the people want what they have fixed, but they don't want the government to step in and do something that makes what they have worse. And I think that a lot of fears about this plan have been planted in the minds of people. It's like, okay, what I have isn't perfect, but I don't, you know, I don't want to be denied treatment if my doctor and I believe I need it. And that's where a lot of people are afraid this is going.
I'm Katty Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, we have a few minutes left on the program. Do call 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Is the address. Let's go to Mike in St. Louis, Missouri. Mike, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, Jim. Yeah, I have a long-term solution. It won't help clearly initially, but we buy a house with a mortgage, and initially most of what you pay on a monthly payment is interest, and as you acquire the mortgage, your 30 years, you get equity. It seems like we could do the same thing for a health insurance plan. It would have to be done probably through the tax system, because when young people don't tend to want to buy a 30-year mortgage on health care. But if we did this, we would actually build equity for each person, and this could be a private organization. So we would share the profits of the investment with the insurance companies, and we would start to have some decision control about our health care and how we spend it, which would ultimately bring the cost of medicine down. So it's an idea.
There's something sort of that would work that way in this bill, the so-called individual mandate, the requirement that people would have to go out and get insurance, whether they felt like they needed it or not, you know, on the off, first of all, so that they're out there subsidizing people who are sicker and more expensive, but also on the idea that you never know when, you know, you're going to run into a truck in an intersection.
Okay, briefly, we've got a couple of minutes on the program. I want to ask each of you what you're going to be watching for on Thursday and what you think is going to happen next. Marilyn.
I'm going to be watching to see how many Republicans are rolling their eyes. If they come in seriously and perhaps bring any kind of a proposal, it'll be interesting to see if it's really considered. But I wouldn't expect to see anything, any kind of major compromise. I think we're looking at a Democratic plan with maybe a few Republican elements eventually included.
Laura.
I'm going to be looking for the interactions between President Obama and congressional Republicans to see how they play off of one another and whether either one is able to coax an admission or some sort of a statement that will come back to haunt the other side.
And what do you think happens after Thursday?
After Thursday, I think the Democratic leadership assesses whether they have the votes to move this forward. And if the White House wants this, they go out and do a sales job, especially among House Democrats, to see if they'll rally behind it.
And what do you rate the chances?
I am, at this point, I think they're probably hovering in the 25 to 30% range.
Okay, Karen, what do you look for on Thursday?
Well, I will be really interested in seeing if either side has any truly new ideas to put on the table, because I think all of us are going to be feeling a little antsy if an hour into this we haven't heard anything that we haven't heard before.
And you mentioned earlier that you think there might be the possibility of medical insurance reform.
I'm just saying my hunch is that the White House has something. Because there was nothing in this bill, at least that I could see, to reach out to the Republicans, my feeling is I wouldn't be surprised if they have something in there on Thursday.
Okay. Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Laura Meckler of The Wall Street Journal, Marilyn Serafini of The National Journal, thank you all so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. I've been sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.